Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session from Mesa City Council for Thursday, October 7th, 2010. Would like to, first of all, excuse Councilmember Dina Higgins, who's feeling a little bit under the weather this morning. Hope she feels better. I would think that coming to a study session would be extremely therapeutic.
Hasn't worked yet.
Might allow her time for a good nap. Well, we hope she gets better. She's feeling better. First item on the agenda this morning is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on consumers' use of fireworks within the city of Mesa. And I see men in white shirts.
Knights in white satin.
Mr. Chief, how you doing?
Sir. Thank you, members. As you recall, this last session at the state's legislature, state law was changed to allow the sale of fireworks, not all fireworks, not aerials or some of the big firework activities, but allow sale to members of our community 16 years and under. As a result, it's put local jurisdictions in a position to determine whether or not or how they may allow the use of these. Currently, our fire code indicates that fireworks are not only prohibited for use, but they're obviously prohibited for sale. So we have a conflict with state ordinance. This morning we wanted to bring this issue before you, sort of lay out what the tenets of the statute are, how other cities are beginning to work with this issue and develop their alternatives, and then ultimately get feedback from you in terms of some direction, how the council would like to go on this issue. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chief Stubbs this morning. He's going to give you a very brief presentation, then we can begin to take your input. Thank you.
Mayor and Council, thank you for the time this morning. As Chief Beck pointed out, I'm going to cover just some high points of the bill itself. I'm not going to go through the whole thing with you. You've had this in your packet. Again, the law takes effect December 1st, 2010, so December of this year. Some of the finer points in it are that incorporated cities and towns may regulate the use of permissible consumer fireworks within their incorporated city limits. One of the things we handed out to you this morning that we didn't have in your packet was a map that shows, and I just put it up here on the Elmo, of the unincorporated areas of the city. The shaded gray area are the unincorporated. The two big ones in the center, of course, are Dreamland Villa and Leisure World. The which you see right here by our future station 220 and the one by station 209. The majority of the unincorporated areas are on the far eastern border of the city. So that gives you an idea roughly of what we're looking at for the unincorporated areas.
And Dan, once you mentioned that, is it our understanding that Maricopa County is not going to restrict the
Yes.
The word use, or is it, what is it, the word use?
The use.
Of
yes.
Fireworks?
That's our understanding as of today. Most jurisdictions, including counties, are still, we've only had three jurisdictions, which I'll show you in a little bit, that have made any kind of decision on this. But presently, Maricopa County is saying that they aren't going to take any action. So if we prohibit the use within our city limits, those county islands within the city may still be using fireworks. So we want to make sure you were aware of that. Now, typically, again, what happens if there's an injury or if there's a fire, unless it, all those county areas right now are pretty much handled by Rural Metro. If the incident goes beyond their control, we may be requested for mutual aid. That happens, a dozen times a year now. It doesn't happen every day. We would not get the call initially. We would have to wait for a call from Rural Metro to come in to assist them. So there's a potential that in those county islands that we may be asked to render some aid.
Chief, Councilmember Summers.
Out of curiosity, Rural Metro seems to keep shrinking. What are their assets and capabilities currently for the East County?
They have, in this area right now, they've got two stations. And I believe they have three units, but I'm not 100% sure, but I know they have three stations. They have one on Power Road just south of University, and they have another one on University and Chrisman. And then their other assets they have are farther down in the Johnson Ranch area, down by Queen Creek. that's pretty much limits their capabilities on the east side.
Okay, do you know what they have as far as wildland fire capabilities there?
No, I don't for sure. I do know that during the summer months when we have our wildland fires, we rarely get called in these county areas for wildland fires, so that they do have some capabilities to take care of that. Other things to just quickly to point out, the bill does not prohibit by ordinance further regulation for sales and possession of fireworks other than their permissible consumer fireworks, which means that everything that's sold, as Chief Beck just pointed out, can't explode. These aren't by design. These are ground fountains, snakes, sparklers, but nothing that has an impact explosion on it is allowed to be sold. Local jurisdictions can permit the quantities in excess amounts. Again, NFPA standards and other local standards affect how much the stores can have on hand, how much they can store, where they have to be stored. So we're not really too worried about that too much because the regulations in the NFPA pretty much establishes that already. The bullet about the 6-1 down is probably one of the more important ones to point out. It states the state forester may require reimbursement from cities and other political subdivisions if anything happens that would go on federal land. The area of concern that we have is up in Los Angeles area. We border the national forest up there. So if we'd have something that could spread from the Los Angeles area into the federal land up there and it causes us and them to react to it, they may, by this law, ask for some reimbursement of that. So I wanted to make sure you're aware of that. Just to kind of wrap things up, virtually every jurisdiction in the valley is looking at that. To date, again, this was put in your packet this morning because we held off until it was kind of to the last minute. We've got three jurisdictions that have passed ordinances. That's Carefree, Fountain Hills, and Goodyear. All of them have restricted the use. All the other jurisdictions are kind of taking a wait and see attitude. Most of them don't even have it coming up on their calendars until the end of this month or the first part of November. So we're about the fourth or fifth one in the system that's already before council. But it gives you an idea on the matrix we have out here. Most of the jurisdictions right now, at least from the fire departments, are moving forward at the recommendation of their council to prohibit the use. You've got a few that are allowing the use. But again, that's the recommendations only. Nothing has been passed other than Carefree, Fountain Hills, and Goodyear.
I may point out, too, that the law takes effect December the 1st. So we are a little bit ahead of the game here, which we'd like to be, because if we're going to take some specific action, we need a period of time for public education to inform everybody. The vendors, from a regional perspective, are stocking up their supplies, and in some cases, some have already leaked out into the cities and have been used a little bit. So it's important for us to have an action and a position to take on this that we can manage effective December the 1st.
And as Mr. Brady pointed out just a few minutes ago, that Maricopa County currently is taking no action other than outline, which is in the law, which states that the county may regulate the use of permissible consumer fireworks within the unincorporated areas. At times when there's reason, except for times when there's reasonable risk of wildland fires or to the immediate county. What we've heard from the state, from the county, is that they're going to treat it so much like no burn days. If they feel that it's the day of the use, which we haven't even determined what days those might be, but some of the bigger ones are obviously 4th of July, but New Year's Eve and maybe a few other ones. If the conditions are right, the state may come out and say we're going to prohibit them in the use of the county, but they won't know that. They've told us they won't make the decision on that until the day of that event. So there won't be any really advanced warning. Consumers will be able to buy them. I'm not sure how they're going to get the message out. When I asked that question to them, they didn't have a good answer on how they were going to get the word out that no, you can't use them. The no burn days are pretty much, they've got a method for that, but I'm not sure how they're going to handle this. So our recommendation from the fire department, based on some of the things we've told you, is to prohibit the use of the consumer fireworks within the city limits. Some of the alternatives we have that we've listed down here are restrict the sales of consumer fireworks within certain occupancies in designated areas. We know some jurisdictions are doing that. Talking with our legal department, we find that that may be somewhat problematic, how the law is written. We can also establish a permit fee for the sale of fireworks. This would help us recover some costs maybe to print education material and get that out to the consumers. In addition to the permit, require a business license. One of the reasons why we say that is that might stop somebody from just selling them on the street corner. Limit the use to certain days of the year. A lot of jurisdictions are doing this instead of having a wholesale open free range, as you would say, on fireworks after December 1st, is to say, okay, they can be used on these particular days. And again, I gave you some examples like 4th of July, New Year's Eve, maybe a few other ones. Limit to certain hours of the day and limit the sales to such as 2 weeks before an approved holiday. And then one of the last ones that we kind of put together is require a consumer permit, which includes the safety packet approved by the fire marshal. That way everybody that buys these will get some kind of safety information that tells a little bit more about them. And the fiscal impact, it's really unknown at this time. We've had fireworks injuries and firework fires since I've been on the fire department. They've been very infrequent because they're not legal to use, but we really can't.
Chief, let me stop you there. Do you really think they've been infrequent because they're illegal, or do you think they're infrequent because the types of fireworks you're talking about, it just doesn't happen with these types? Because my experience is most people could care less whether they're illegal. You know, if you're talking about a snake or a right. sparkler, you know, we're not talking M80s or even firecrackers here. We're talking, you know, things that you put in the street that, you know, spew forth and then they go away. So, you know, I think you're making a jump there to say because they're illegal, you've had few things. Could it be the type of firework that you have?
I think mostly that's it, Mayor, is that where we've seen the injuries and even some of the fires is on some of the things that explode, your bottle rockets.
Which isn't going to change no matter what, because those are still going to be illegal.
Correct. Those are illegal. So if we have instances with those are because consumers are bringing them in anyway.
Well, let me ask you something. The state law, did it basically negate everything that we have so we have to take action? Or because it's under our ordinance right now, these types of fireworks are prohibited, correct? Or not? What did state law do to override or to replace or to negate the ordinance we have in place right now?
Mayor, in the ordinance or the statute itself, it did establish that fireworks are a matter of statewide concern. So in essence, it has preempted the field. So by taking no action at all, our ordinance that we have in place would go
basically
away.
Basically negated our ordinance.
Correct.
But it allowed us, if we want to take action, we can, in essence, reinstate.
That's correct. It allows a provision for the count for the cities to regulate the sale of the fireworks and the use, excuse me, of the fireworks. The reason that the county has a limitation is that in the ordinance itself, it specifically says they're only allowed to take action when they feel there is a threat to fire
the
suppression
counties.
Or fire the counties. I'm sorry. So the counties actually have less. Availability to
does
impose
it
regulations.
State counties, or does it talk yeah. about charter or home rule or that type of stuff?
No, let me read you the statute as it's written. With respect to the counties, it says a county may regulate the use of permissible consumer fireworks within the unincorporated areas of the county during times when there is a reasonable risk of wildfires in the immediate county. So it doesn't say that they can do this all the time. I think that's the reason that the county is taking no action is that this time is because they could not go out there and establish a county ordinance to ban them entirely. I think the statute, the way it's written, says they can only act okay. during the time that there is a
Chief,
a
let
wild
me ask you something. If we want to just basically what you're saying is you want to maintain the status quo in Mesa,
correct?
Correct. why would we look at any other complication or added burden other than what we already have? I mean, the fact of the matter is, no matter what we do, we got major parts of our city, and actually the highest risk parts of our city, where these are not going to be regulated, except for maybe on a, what do you call it, a no-sparkle day?
Reasonable
a
risk.
Declared no-sparkle day.
A reasonable risk of wildfire is the way the statute reads.
Yeah, no-sparkle day.
No-sparkle.
I mean, you know, that's not going to change regardless of what we do. We got large sections of our city that there's going to be fireworks for sale and for use. You know, why would we even try to make something more complicated than what we already have? If we don't want to use them, wouldn't we just take what we already have and just basically reaffirm it? Or is there a gap what we have in the law we have right now?
Well, Mayor, if I'm understanding your question, if you say take what we currently have, I think I'm misunderstanding here. What we currently have
is
they can't be used. Is what we currently have is they're not allowed within the city.
Okay. Now,
and if you take that and reapply it, then we would be applying a ban. But I think what you're trying to say is
that's what I'm saying. You understood correctly. Okay. So why wouldn't we just say, all right, if we don't want people to use fireworks in our city, why wouldn't we just take the wording we already have and just have the council reaffirm it without getting into all the licensing and sections and all that kind of stuff that there's no way we're going to be able to enforce that anyway?
We kind of agree with you.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that's our recommendation.
Oh, okay. Councilmember Cavanaugh.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mayor. I don't think we need to dilute the message by adding complications or confusion. Simply, I think we should work to reinstate our existing ordinance, which is to prohibit the use. There's legitimate public health, safety, and welfare issues for us as a community. That's why we enacted the ordinance in the first place. Those reasons haven't changed, and I think the mayor's on the right course. Thank you.
Mayor, I think the other items that were presented were just alternatives, but I think recommendation is where you are right now.
Now, I was wondering if there was something in the state law or something we were worried about that maybe we need to take action on.
I think we're consistent with where you are now.
But understanding that, you know, if I want to if I want to have my sparkle, or I can just basically walk across and go to the whatever store selling it in the county island, get it, and come back, and I'd be in the same position I am right now, except for instead of buying it in New Mexico or Colorado or Utah or California or all the other places where these are legal, or any other place in Arizona, I just wouldn't be able to buy it in Mexico.
Now, Mayor, let me be clear. You said,
and I mean, it'll be illegal too.
You can purchase it. We can't ban the purchase because they'll be selling them in Mesa.
Okay.
We can only ban the use.
Well, see, that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah. Is that correct? Am I saying that correctly?
Correct, Mayor. The use is what we are prohibiting here today. The sale of the
fireworks. Okay, so you have a situation where someone would buy it in the Walgreens on this side of the road, and we just want to make sure they walk across Apache Trail to the other side to use them.
Correct.
So if they're going to start a fire from their sparkler, we want to make sure you do it in the county, not in Mesa. I mean, this seems sort of absurd to me. So we can't prohibit the sale, but we can prohibit the use.
Well, we do.
Gotcha. Yes. Okay. Sometimes I love our legislature. Go ahead. Councilmember Fenter.
Well, to offer the other side of the other view of this, and man, I hate being put in this position. So everywhere in the city of Mesa, the 16-year-olds will be able to buy fireworks, but the second they walk out the door with their handful of fireworks, we're going to prohibit them using them. Pretty crazy spot to be put in, right? Is that because we can't prohibit the sale, but we can prohibit the use?
That's correct.
Mayor brings up a good point. Surroundings, states, you go to Rocky Point. The irony is, if you, at least in District 2 that I've seen, is it's 4th of July about every other weekend.
That's because you're so patriotic in that.
No.
True patriots.
An observer of the obvious as these things are going off. And the positive thing that I'd like to see, you know, 4th of July, just bear with me. Travel with the family reunions, surrounding states, have had wonderful memories. with the little kids, with the sparklers. I've been just, you know, family members are responsible adults. We make sure they have this wonderful opportunity. We have pictures, great memories. What's the problem I have with this whole thing is, as responsible, we have a room filled with responsible adults that would love for their kids or grandkids to have maybe a little sparkler, enjoy that kind of deal. I just wish we would look at some options, some compromise and meeting in the middle a little bit. I can tell you the feedback I've gotten is folks would like to have some of those opportunities in their community at home under really responsible, well-controlled situations to enjoy those kind of things with their families. What I'm hearing is that nothing we're just going to go with. I don't think there's the support, but I'll throw that out there. I think there's some way to find a compromise and make it pretty simple. So,
Councilman Fender, I want you to know my grandchildren sparkle all the time.
They do.
Vice Mayor.
All right, more clarification then. The prohibition of use is for explosive, not sparkler, or is it everything? Early on in the discussion, you were mentioning the differentiation between the sparklers and the small things as opposed to those that actually explode, bottle rockets and such.
Mayor and Vice Mayor, our recommendation is what the mayor had said earlier, is just to keep what the city has currently on the books, which is no use of fireworks within the city.
But Dan, clarify.
Clarify fireworks.
Clarify what can be sold. What is even allowed to be sold in the stores, wherever, does not include.
Right.
Explosives.
Yeah. Anything explosive.
Or
firecrackers, rockets, bottle rockets. Anything explodes or goes up in the air is prohibited from sale.
So we have no bang days.
The only thing allowed for sale is the sparklers and the small items that
aren't
explosive.
Things like that will. You can set on the ground that it will spray up and make those kind of things. Novelty things you can put on the ground. We don't have available for you today because it's not finished yet, but we could get that to you. Is we had sales reps come out to our training facility and put a display on for us. We just don't have the footage available for that, just for you to see all the different types of apparatus. But basically, we describe things that don't explode, things that don't go in the air.
And that's what is allowed for sale.
Yes.
But the use within the city historically has been none whatsoever, sparklers and all.
Correct.
Which is basically nearly impossible to enforce because of the amount of use.
Well, do we enforce it? Even if it weren't impossible, I mean,
the position. Excuse me, the mayor, members of the council, the position that the city has taken on this historically is that if we have an incident where somebody gets injured or
they can be
we
cited.
Have a fire, then we have a recourse. If we allow the use, we're going to accept the responsibility of managing whatever results from that. Another key point I would like to, as we work through this issue, we'll give you a chance to see some of the things that are approved for sale. We have witnessed demos over the last several months to see what that is. And one of the things that concerns me that hasn't been brought forward yet with this type of firework, even though it is not an aerial and it doesn't go boom, is that it's not just simple sparkler that somebody holds in their hand that, you know, we've seen people use in the past or on birthday cakes or things like that. What this allows is an array of sparklers coming from a container that's about this big and about this tall, that spews sparkler, which is basically metal that's burning, spews this 6 to 8 feet in the air. And one of the things we witnessed when we did the demo, as you guys who have probably all used fireworks in other states, I'm sure where it was legal, is that you can light the fuse, and then if you're not sure if it's going to go off, you want to go back and check it. And so one of the hazards with that, especially, and clearly that's the biggest hazard, isn't it, with fireworks is in terms of personal injury, is that if it doesn't go off the way it was designed, you want to check it, and then you expose yourself to a higher hazard. One of the concerns I have is that a lot of these sparklers, it's not the simple handheld sparkler we're talking about here. We're talking about a small sparkler show.
And, Chief, if I could play devil's advocate here just quick, I don't disagree with you, but if we were a legislative committee, that's great testimony. The fact of the matter is it just seems like we're in an absurd position where they can buy exactly what we can't prohibit the sale of exactly what you're saying.
Correct.
Within our city. Okay, so where does that leave us? Other than the point you bring up that if we're trying to create some kind of legal foothold where we can hold someone responsible for the improper use of that, that's fine. Otherwise, I mean, it just seems like an absurdity of the law that we have no control over the sale of something that the second they walk out of that store, they can't light the fuse, but they can buy it. I don't know. I get it from a firefighter standpoint, from a safety standpoint. I'm just trying to figure out how the law interacts. It seems like the state sort of pulled the rug out from under us because it creates an absurd situation. Oh, Vice Mayor, then Councilmember Summers.
I would like, this doesn't take effect till December 1st. I'd like to digest a little bit and get feedback and try and work on some verbiage that we could work with. I don't think there's a rush to get it done today.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was not aware that it prohibited us from controlling the sale. Or not controlling, but prohibiting the sale. That's a double prohibiting, but it does. I didn't realize that till today. Somehow, I missed that. And that changes the train of thought for me also. Councilmember Summers.
The only people that this new law benefits are going to be the people selling this thing. This is what happens when lobbyists get to write the laws. They don't care. The fireworks manufacturers and sellers, they don't care if you don't ever get to use them. They just want to make money on the sale. And these things are incredibly dangerous. Chief, I differ with you. I think the sparklers are far more dangerous because everybody's held one in their hands. Anybody who grew up back east anyway seems to have held one in their hands. Well, what's the danger in that? Well, you can get away with it just for so long before somebody gets burned. But these things aren't made here. There's no quality assurance. They're made in China. They're made in Mexico. The fuses go off or they don't sometimes, and then they go to relight them and they blow up, or the fuse isn't as long as it's supposed to be and they blow up. If you want to blow off your own hand, I don't care. That's your own business. The problem with these sparklers in particular is they cause fires and create damage to people whose property who had nothing to do with the sale, the purchase, or the use of these things. And it wasn't maybe 10 days after this law passed the legislature in Scottsdale, where a couple of kids with illegal fireworks lit off a bunch of oleanders, by the way, toxic when burning, and burned down a neighbor's house who had nothing to do with the sale or use, and killed their family dog. And luckily, no humans were home at the time, because it probably would have harmed them too, and it also burned the neighbor's house. There is a significant community risk from these things. And I think, Chief, when you come back to present this to council, we need to provide a visual of exactly how dangerous these things actually are. Take one of these darn things and shove it in a brittle bush and give it half a second and ignite it and show us the tape. It'd be nice, too, if you would have a fire truck around so that you don't burn down, Usury Mountain. When you're doing this.
I'm sorry.
But, no, I'm sorry. I thought he was trying to get my attention. It was a different Scott. The fact that you can buy them and can't sell them, I think there's a recourse. I don't think that the city should condone that. Part of this discussion, even though we can't deal anything with the sale of these things, we can regulate things like signage, that you can state you cannot use these in the city limits as a possibility. The fact that the county doesn't want to deal with it is not a surprise. The county doesn't deal with fire protection anyway. I don't think the county has much authority to do anything, and that's an issue they're going to have to deal with. City of Mesa, we need to deal with the City of Mesa issues. So I would support a ban.
Councilman Richens.
I grew up in California as a kid where all the what's been legalized, I guess, is what we used. We didn't get to use. Well, that's That was later after I left. We didn't get to the ones that shoot up and explode and all that. But we could get them and we could use them illegally periodically. But I mean, I never did.
Could use them illegally.
Are we talking about fireworks or marijuana now?
No, the ones that go up and explode, not fireworks.
Like I said, fireworks.
First, and then the
anyway, I remember lots of burns. I remember lots of little one-off fires that happened from just the ones that you guys are describing. I have no problem banning these fireworks. Even if they're legal for sale in our stores, doesn't mean we have to be able to use them in our city limits. I like Councilmember Summers' suggestion about requiring a big label on there saying, you may purchase these, but you may not use these in the city limits of Mesa. I know sometimes law is meant to protect people from themselves, and these are the kind of products that people get their hands on, and you have to protect them from themselves. I'm just stunned at the legislature once again doesn't think through these ordinances and bills when they're passing them. What are the ramifications? They don't coordinate with the cities. They're not thinking, they don't have to provide fire service, so why should they care? And exactly as Councilmember Summers says, this is a result of lobbyists in there writing these laws and not thinking through the ramifications. So I am in total support of a ban on these things in our city limits. And sure, knock yourself out, sell them, but doesn't mean that you can use them.
I actually think they thought through very carefully, and they didn't care. No, yes. I don't. I think it's a little
whichever.
Bit. Yeah, no, I don't think this is lobbyist driven in the sense that nobody knew what was going on. I think they actually knew what was going to go on, and they had a different purpose. Councilmember Summers.
As a personal anecdote, too, it's not a secret that I've worked in the fire service a good portion of my life. One of the things that we do, and I'm embarrassed now. Fire Prevention Week next week?
It's this week.
This week. See, I'm really embarrassed now.
President, what do you do?
I don't do public ed. That was somebody else on the council. But I'm a downtown station now, so we don't have a lot of schools. But if I were at my old firehouse, we'd be going out to all the schools in the area, talking to the kids. And one of our little lectures is a game we play. Is it a tool or is it a toy? And we hold up a toy, it's a toy. We hold up a set of matches, it's a tool. Welding torch is a tool. It serves a purpose. Are they dangerous? Yes. Are matches dangerous? Yes, but they're a tool. Are barbecues dangerous? Yes, but they're a tool. We cook things with them. A firework is neither a toy nor a tool. It's not a safe toy by any stretch of the imagination, and it serves no other purpose than entertainment. And I've been on two professional fireworks displays now on a standby in the fire service that I have seen literally explode right next to me, one of which I was in Fountain Hills at the time working for Rural Metro, sitting behind this thing on a mountain, and the bush that was 5 feet away from my brush truck was on fire because the thing tipped over and exploded. And these were professional pyrotechnic operators working these systems. That's how dangerous these things are. Now you want to invite that into your home. You wouldn't let your child handle matches or a lighter or the food on the stove. Why you would want to hand them a sparkler, I don't know, particularly when it burns down houses as we've seen in Scottsdale. So I just want to throw that in, that I hope, despite the fact, even if we ban them here, the sale is still legal, and I hope people make the right decision and decide, rather than trying to use these things themselves and possibly harming themselves or their neighbor or their child, that they come to the professional events like the, Mayor, what's ours? The new one you started?
Freedom Celebration,
and watch them there.
And burn their sparklers there?
No,
yeah. In the middle of the crowd.
Watch the professional pyrotechnic people.
I think we get it. You're preaching to the choir here. We get it that things that burn really hot can burn things other than the sparklers. We get that. My quandary is twofold. Number one, we can't restrict sales. The question is, how much can we regulate sales? Because you know, we can talk about all the things that burn. That's a moot point. The legislature has said we cannot prohibit the sales in the city.
Correct.
All right? And the fact of the matter is that we tend to focus on the 12 and the 13-year-olds, and the legislature was thinking more of the grandpas and the parents that Councilmember Finter had, where there's adult supervision, and there's a valid question is, wait a second, why should we as government play the nanny state and tell a grandpa who's an adult, who's very careful that, no, you can't go light a fountain out in the middle of the street when you're under adult supervision? To me, that's a valid argument to have. But that really is another thing that gets past the point that we cannot stop the sale. The question I have is that how can we regulate either the way it's sold or the signage or whatever? Because it just seems absurd that you can walk out of a Walgreens with a sparkler and you can't use it on the sidewalk. That creates a real quandary for me as to how you balance those two.
Well, Mayor, if I can add, under the statute, it does allow for regulation. It doesn't state exactly what regulations are prohibited or permissible. So my thought on this is that we were discussing it. It's no different than any other product that you're going to sell within the city. So it has to meet, if you're going to establish a retail establishment, it has to be situated in an appropriate zoning area. You can regulate the sale, as some cities are doing, only for certain holidays. You can regulate the times that they can be sold, say from 10 to 4. All those options are still on the table for you. The basic premise, though, from the statute is that you just cannot prohibit the sale entirely. Regulating when they are sold, how they are sold, that is still on the table for you.
Well, I would, and I don't see any recommendation on specifics related to that here today. I would, and maybe the rest of the council would like to see, come back and give us some suggestions as to what we might do to things that we can actually impact. Because it seems like with the use, it's either use it or don't use it. And I guess it seems like the only thing we have is, do we want to, you know, we can't, maybe we can say sell it and use it, or don't use it, sell it at a certain time, like on the 4th of July or something like that. But I'd like to see some more specifics as to what ideas you might have as to how we could regulate the sale. Because I don't know, just worth the Vice Mayor and then Councilman Fenton.
And just one last comment before I have to leave to go to a Metro Rail event. Not diminishing at all the dangers. We all get that. We don't need to be shown how serious it is and how dangerous it is. We all get that. My earlier comment, and I reiterate again, we don't need to make a fast decision today, but rather we need to be able to. And when I say decision, I'm talking about looking at all the options of what we can do to minimize the impact of what the legislature's done to us. Because I think we all pretty much agree that it was that it is almost counterproductive when it comes to a safety standpoint, and we need to be able to find out how we can mitigate that to minimize the impact on our community. So with ideas that you can come up with and ideas that the council can give, such as the signage, when it's sold, all that kind of stuff. We need, like I said, time to digest it and come up with ideas, get in touch with you, get those ideas together, and then bring it back to another study session.
Well, I'd also like to see something that places responsibility. I mean, if we don't want to regulate use, I mean, I like the idea in government that we don't tell people what they can and can't do. I think the missing point there, though, is we don't do anything with the consequences. I mean, I do care if someone blows their hand off, because if their blowing the hand off means that me as a taxpayer now have to support that person the rest of their life. At that point in time, their consequence, their action now affects me. I think that, you know, rather we tend to try and prohibit, which is the easiest thing for government to do. And sometimes when you can't do that, we at least ought to try and figure out a way to place responsibility. And if the grandpa does want to go out and shoot off things or burn things with his grandkids, if that grandpa ends up burning someone's house down, the law should say you're responsible for that. Councilmember Fender had a comment, I think.
Thank you. Agree with that. If you could, in the research, get the statistics maybe over the last 5 years of firework-related concerns, and maybe especially on 4th of July and New Year's Eve, and see if we've had a problem. I realize we're talking about increasing, but the reality is, and again, I think someone just needs to drive out and see what really goes on in this community with fireworks, and then see what problem we've had. The other one would be if you could draft some sort of compromise ordinance that might include those specific holidays, responsible adults, 18 years and older. I think it's crazy 16-year-olds can go and buy this and with no supervision at all. But, you know, in our society, I think 18, at least in Arizona, is recognized as a, you know, pretty standard that somebody ought to be responsible enough to do some of the things that they do. So I appreciate that kind of research.
Councilmember Richens.
One more idea for you. If you could include in every pack of sold fireworks a written waiver that they have to go get signed by the local legislator who passed this stupid law, I would really appreciate that. That goes right to the accountability issue.
Councilmember Richens, you really want to call it a stupid law?
Yes, I do.
Ill-advised law. Okay, so what I've heard is that we need to look at, if you could come back with some options and suggestions. I, you know, like I said, for me, the knowledge today or the information that we can't prohibit the sales, that changes things for me, because I'm still trying to digest exactly what that means. If you could come back with some things as far as reasonable regulation of sales, whether it be by time or whether it be by presentation, days of the year, and also then to follow up on what Councilmember Age would be one of those, if we can do that. I think, doesn't the state law say we can't do it?
16,
so we can't change that.
Purchase.
Well, just look into it and
see what those restrictions are, see what we can do, and then also purchase, come back with some ideas as it relates to, Alex, you said some reasonable use, perhaps, you know, how could we make it possible on certain days with adult supervision or adult use? Just some ideas so we can try and balance those two. Because I think we have to deal with also the reality is, you know, the pictures you paint, we get it. But the reality is if we're going to sell in Mesa, to expect that no one's going to use it, I think that's beyond reality. It's just not the case. And I feel a conflict where we have somebody who can buy something in our city, they walk out the door, and all of a sudden it's illegal. And I think the reality is we're going to have a problem. So I agree with Alex that some sort of compromise may need to be had. Is that anything else that? And then of course, straight prohibition is always on the table. Hey, Dave.
Councilman Richens. You guys can't walk out, or else our meeting ends.
Good. That's a good strategy. I like that.
Mayor, if I may make one other comment.
Yeah.
I think it's important to look at the data, but maybe not look at the data locally. We should look at the data for areas.
Whatever data is relevant.
Yes, and this is the concern, has been the concern for years with the fire service with regard to fireworks in arguably the driest state in the country.
Yeah.
We are concerned that this is a tactic to get the nose under the tent. If you look at other states that have legalized fireworks, they have all the regulations and all the things that we're going to explore here, but it happened in a very progressive kind of way, is that once it gets established, it begins to escalate into the aerial devices, because you can make the same case.
Well, Chief, I tell you, the nose, the whole head's under the tent right now. I mean, the camel's halfway there, and we didn't do it. And I think,
exactly. Well,
how we have to look at it is I'm not trying to diminish your arguments. I think we all agree with it. I think the fact is we're trying to deal with our reality, which is the legislature's already opened the door. I mean, we can't undo that. Now, I understand part of the argument that, well, we don't want to further enable that. But on the other hand, we are dealt with the reality that the legislature legalized the sale of these devices.
Well, there's no
question. And legalize the use unless we come back and do something else. And I think what we're trying to do is figure out a balance where we can actually have something that's workable and enforceable. And we just like some different options and ideas to see how far we go. We're not arguing with you, and I don't think there's anyone sitting here trying to argue that these things can't be dangerous or don't create problems. We'd like to see the extent of that. And I mean, if you go to Utah or California or someplace like that, that would be good data. But I'm trying to balance the fact the legislature's already opened the door to the tent. How do we deal with it as a community? And just to say no, I don't think is going to solve the problem unless that's all we want to do. If we want to make a statement and say we want to stop it, so we're going to say no, I understand where you're coming from, and that may be one of the recommendations. If we want to stop this slippery slope from getting even slippier, I can get that. But I don't think it's realistic to expect our citizens to buy something and then say you can't use it and expect them to follow that. That's not human nature. So I don't know where you end up. I don't have an answer for it. We'd like to have some options to see where we can maximize the benefit for the public and deal with our reality, which is the legislature threw us a nice little curveball. Is that the sentiment here? Anything else need to add? Okay.
We're good for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Once Councilmember Summers comes back, Councilmember Richards, you can take a break too. Oh, okay. Next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on priorities for use of Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, and Home Investment Partnership, HOME, funding. Carolyn, is Ray coming up also? Okay, and Ray.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. This morning, we're coming to Council to, first of all, just to state that we've begun our application process for the 2011-2012 CDBG and home funding programs. And just as a background, both these programs, Community Development Block Grant and Home Investment Programs, are part of the HUD's Department of U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And it's an annual allocation process that we get every year. And what we're doing is we're asking or seeking direction from the council on some of the priorities for both the CDBG and home funds, which are included not only in the strategic initiatives, but also beyond those initiatives to make sure that we are doing what the council wants us to do with the programs. And part of our process will be to take these recommendations before the Housing Advisory Board. And last year was the first time we did this. And it was a training session for the Housing Advisory Board since they had not done this before. But this year we've created a rating tool for them to use as part of the process. And then we're planning on forwarding their recommendations to the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee for adjustment or improvement for recommendation to make sure that everybody's part of that process. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Carolyn Olson, our Housing and Revitalization Director, who's going to give us a little bit of background about the program, some of the limitations of the programs, some of the things that we funded before in the past, and the direction, and that, therefore kind of educating the council a little bit what we can do and cannot do with the program. With that, Carolyn?
Good morning, Mayor and Council.
Carolyn?
Yes.
Councilmember Kavanaugh, I think.
I just wanted to confirm in terms of the Community Development Block Grant applications, aren't those also reviewed by the Human Services Advisory Board? I know the home applications are reviewed by the Housing Advisory Board.
We haven't done that.
But Human is that what you're asking if we
have? I was asking, yeah.
The Human Services Advisory Board only reviews the Human Services applications.
Okay.
And not the CDBG applications.
Okay. That's the clarification. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a little confused at that because aren't CDBG, and I guess it's maybe for the purpose they're using, they go to Human Services agencies, but it's what they're used for. It's not where they. It's not who takes them. It's what they're used for. Is that accurate?
The difference between the two is the human services funding are guidelines that are set by the council, and the CDBG and the home ones are guidelines that are set by.
And I guess where the confusion is, though, that we have agencies that are human service agencies that get CDBG funding.
Yes.
You know, Mark Center.
Right.
Crisis. Those are human services.
Yes.
But we have put CDBG, but they're for specific, usually for capital issues or things like that. or something like that, or do we send them for?
It can be. I don't know if it's limited to.
It can be public service.
I'm just talking about our internal policy because now I'm getting where what Dennis is talking about, because I'm trying to get the idea of where the split is. When does it go to the Human Services Advisory Board, and when does it just stay in the CDBG? Source of funding or use?
Source of funding and the use, both.
Well, basically source of funding.
But I think the focus is really on the idea that the HUD process, the CDBG, and its requirements are very distinct than the general fund. And they have we have a very prescribed process.
Okay. So basically general fund disbursements for human services, just human services agencies, go through the Human Services Advisory. CDBG do not.
Correct.
Regardless of what they're used for.
Right.
Or who they go to.
Right.
Gotcha. Is that an answer? Okay, go ahead. Dave.
Could we if we wanted to? Could we add other
advisory boards? We've been going through the housing. As we mentioned, we went to the housing board. But if council, I don't know if you want to go through both.
Yeah,
or
if we wanted to continue to build consensus towards what we're working on, which is part of what this discussion is. I just wanted to throw that out. It's an option.
Because of the nature of some of these projects, I think because of a lot of the housing-related activities that are funded out of HUD, that's probably why we went there. But certainly, you're right, kind of from the public service or the service part of it, there are certainly some correlations with what the Human Services Board looks at. So we could make that decision. I don't know if you want to go through two different boards or what, but that's up to the council, certainly.
I don't know. Let's see how this ends up.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
And again, just a follow-up question, because you're asking us as part of the directions this morning what our priorities are for CDBG funds. I'm focusing on that as an example. And I guess my concern is, the council has indicated, for example, economic development is a priority for use of CDBG funds. And yet we don't ask, at least I don't see in the process where we're going to ask for input from our Economic Development Advisory Board on applications that we may have for economic development purposes. And I guess my concern is the Housing Board is too limited in terms of a public process if you're seeking community input and consensus, because it's not just housing issues or capital projects like that. I think our council has determined that economic development itself is an important priority for this. So that's where I'm just coming from, Mayor and Council.
I look at what we went through last year, and I think that's probably why it's on our mind. We set priorities, and yet we're a little uncomfortable with all of a sudden getting a spreadsheet that has specific allocations that are within those priorities, but it's an awkward forum for us to get hit with that right off the bat, and then we're looking at that. And I think what I'm hearing is it would be nice if we can set priorities and then there be a process that maybe narrows that down, and maybe I'm missing the point on this.
No, I'm hearing Councilmember
processing that.
I'm trying to kind of think this through, because, and Councilmember Kavanaugh is correct, I mean, the applications will have, and I'm, based on even the discussion here, they'll have some housing component to it. They'll have some, is public service the right term? Am I using that right term? The public service element and then economic development. And so, where is there really one community group that's best at looking at that? Maybe not. You're right. The housing is mostly related to housing, and would they be best looking at economic development? If you wanted, I guess, in theory, you could pull out those areas, the applications that dealt just with, and there are categories of public service, and there's categories related to housing, and we could create one economic development, and we could ask those groups to assess the applications in those areas.
The question I have is, do we care where they go, or are we more interested that they go through some kind of filtering process for a specific application before they get here? Or do we care about that at all? Am I the only one that sees that? I might be, Dave.
I think the answer is yes and yes to that.
Thanks for narrowing it down.
Well, Ray hit on something at the very beginning of this presentation, which I believe shortly will let you continue.
Why should we start now?
You talked about, what the HUD guidelines allow, but you also referenced our council's strategic priorities. And there's copies here available. I have one in front of me here. And there's a lot of gems in our council's strategic priorities that if we were to say we want to fund this specific activity and you put that out there, certainly those projects can go through certain advisory boards. But I'm going to give you an example of of our economic development strategic priority. One is revitalizing downtown by promoting 24/7 uses. And in parentheses, we put 2,000 housing units, higher education, and healthcare industry. So what can we nudge in those items, leveraging some funds that and have it also fall within the HUD guidelines? So say we want to see a quality housing project in downtown Mesa. We could say, in our pot of CDBG money, we're going to set aside X number of dollars for a housing project somewhere within this area and help that facilitate that to happen. That's the kind of targeted thing that I envision that we could do with CDBG. So instead of just getting applications, or people want to do projects, we say these are the kind of projects we want to see done, and then attract the capacity to Mesa to get those projects
done. And I guess the question I have is that matching those projects or agencies with a specific initiative, is that something that right now we rely, at least with CDBG, on staff to hopefully accomplish, or do we want to involve a citizen board and say, listen, if you have two or three different ideas for accomplishing this, do we want that board or to sort of go through the filtering process and set that up as a formal part of the process, or is that something that we would rely on staff to do?
I think more public involvement, the better. I think the public will start buying into these federal dollars being spent.
And so these would be the instructions to both staff and the public board to say, listen, here's our initiative. Take applications or go out and solicit applications or whatever and run them through the process, understanding that this is what the council's looking for.
Right. And okay. See, one of the things I've liked about our city council reports, and I don't know if you can zoom in on this at all, but there's a line item after the date to through from subject memo part, where you have strategic initiative, and it references one or more specific strategic initiatives. And I'd like to see every CDBG application we get reference a council strategic initiative so they know these are our goals, this is what we're trying to accomplish. And as long as it fits the HUD guidelines, we can go forward with that.
Yeah, if I may respond to that, what we've done this year is we have included that in the process. And based on Councilmember Richardson's recommendation, we've included the strategic initiatives with the applications, and we've asked each one of the applicants to make sure that they fit their particular recommendation within one of these initiatives. So it is part of that, and part of our rating tool that we're using for this process will include that also. So yes, we are doing that, and I totally agree. The other thing that we could do, and this is a recommendation that I could throw out, is that we could meet with the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee ahead of time and maybe establish even more detail before we go to the Housing Advisory Board to maybe, you know, establish some of that.
Dave? Yeah.
I think those are all great suggestions. We have a pretty set timeline, I think, for this year, and I think it's great looking over it. So I think probably we should go with the timeline and the advisory boards we have now, but continue this process of refinement over a period of years. So that way, once we publish these timelines, these are the expectations that all of our applicants are following now, and so we probably should kind of stick to this for now. But this is a great evolution from what we did last year.
Absolutely.
And plus, I agree, I appreciated you guys moving the timelines up so far, so we're not in a situation where we get, well, we have to approve this in this meeting in order to get the 30-day notice and the 60-day notice, and every notice is out there in time. So we have lots of time. Lots is probably not the right word. We have time to continue this discussion as within the framework of, I think, the established timeline. So I'm really supportive of this established timeline and boards for this year, but let's continue this discussion as a refining of this process.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know, Councilman Kavanaugh, being to your point, there could certainly be a way based on the categories of activities. We could take those that are related to economic development and go take those to the Economic Development Advisory Board and at least get some input from them. The challenge with the Human Services Board is what we really like to do is, and it doesn't help the timing so off, the general fund decisions versus the HUD decisions, and actually be nice if they were looking at all the applications together for both funding and how they're, you know, kind of pulling them together and looking at how we can get the best utilization. But anyway, I just bring that up. But we can certainly do it as
well. I think that's something the staff can do, though, because they're the ones with the big picture.
No, I don't disagree. It's just that the decisions and the kind of the application process under CVG gets way ahead of where we are on the general fund
gotcha.
Side. So,
Great. And Mayor and Chris, I agree with what you're saying. I think the I think the staff's done a great job in advancing the time requirements for this. I think it makes our job easier and gives the council more time to deliberate on it. Involving the Community Neighborhood Services Committee really up front is helpful. But I do, at least in terms of the economic development issues, I think it would be helpful to get the advice of that board, because that, again, I think the skill sets of people that we asked to serve on that committee may be different than the people that we have asked to serve on the Housing Committee, and I certainly would value their input on at least any applications that have the economic development impact.
Yeah, and even though this doesn't create the most efficient, I found when we get here, this is a policymaking board. Now, granted, we certainly make specific decisions, but as a policymaking body, we don't function best when we're the first group to look at things, because we're trying to mold everything together. And I found that that's when things sort of get muddled here. And it's a lot better if it's gone through a filtering and review where you get some of this input from the community and they can ask the questions. Then we get sort of a body of information that, and you've been able to hear, get some feedback too from other people, so you can tweak things before they get here. And that seems when it works to create a situation that works best. The more input you get definitely isn't as efficient, but I think it makes for a better decision, and it certainly helps us out.
Okay.
And we'll leave it up. I think we can leave it up to you to decide which way it goes, as far as.
If it was helpful, we can.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Should we let him go on now with the presentation, or have we? That is so moved. Okay. Do we have a second? Go on.
I'm done.
Okay. Is there anything else in the, have we completely obliterated the presentation?
Do we need to?
That's fine. No.
Okay. All right. Well, we're just going to kind of go backwards. The first threshold.
We're good at that.
The first threshold of all the applications coming in is we have to make sure that they meet one of the three national objectives: the benefit to the low-mod income people, preventing or eliminating blight, or urgent needs such as hurricane, flood, or those types of situations. So really, it comes down to about two national objectives that each application must meet for the first threshold. After that, we go into, is it an eligible activity? And I'm just going to briefly go over. Housing is an eligible activity with these various categories: homeowner, home purchase, new construction, and rental. We have...
Dave?
I have a question about the housing activities, new construction, rental housing. The ratios are always changing, but for affordable housing, do they... Can you blend affordable housing with market rate housing and use CDBG funds in the same project now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's kind of been evolving into this mixed use allowability, but that's pretty clear now.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Preventing slum and blight is an eligible activity, such as code enforcement. Public facilities are an eligible activity. Public owned. Traditionally provided by government and so forth, shelters of special needs folks. Eligible activities are public service, which we are allowed a maximum of 15% of our allocation to go to public service. The public service has to prove it's a new public service or an increased level of service that they're asking for. Economic development is an eligible activity, which includes job retention and creation, establishing expansion of small business, loans, grants, technical assistance to businesses. Our rating system that we've come up this year, that the Housing Advisory Board has graciously agreed to undertake, it has these categories in it with points assigned to those. And they will be looking at all applications with these things in mind. Also, within that, is there are points for council initiatives. So if they do list that they are in one of the council initiatives, within that is in one of the scoring categories.
Carolyn, mm-hmm. Councilor Kevin has a question.
Sorry to interrupt again. With respect to this round of applications for this next year, will you still be required to use the current CDBG boundaries, or will you have, since it's information, to so that we can understand what the new boundaries may be?
Are you talking the census tracts?
Yeah.
We don't have those yet. They're saying we're going to get those in 2011. So if they apply with the old ones, if the new ones come into effect after that time, then we can amend their application and their contract to take in the new tracts.
Thank you.
But Carolyn, this is kind of the question I had the other day, though. You can have a facility or service outside the CBG eligible. It has to be serving individuals who qualify?
Yes.
Does that, okay. So we're not necessarily restricted to the particular boundaries of the area, but we have to serve the population.
Certain projects. Like code enforcement is within our area.
Code enforcement. Fair enough.
And what you're saying is that if we get the information mid-year that changes those areas, we can amend the contract to include the revised census.
Right. Okay. If we get those and they're ready to do their project even during the next year, we can amend at any time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So here's just a little chart of our funding. We estimate this year to be similar to last. And just an example of some of the programs that we funded in this current year under slum and blight. We have our code enforcement and so forth. I won't read all those. Housing, we did accessibility, rental, homeowner, lead-based paint. Economic development, we did a sprinkler system program, business development loans, operations of a CDC.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that said sparkler assistance program. I was wondering if we had one presentation fold into the other. I'm sorry,
but we can't.
Read it wrong. Yeah. Okay.
No.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So those are some of the ones for economic development. Our public service, here were some of the items that we funded during the current year. Okay, now we're going to talk about the HOME program, the Home Investment Partnership Program. And some of the HUD program objectives are to provide decent, affordable housing to lower-income households, to expand the capacity of our nonprofit housing providers, to strengthen the ability of state and local governments to provide this housing, and to leverage private sector participation. And we have a similar rating tool for our home system. It does vary a little bit because some of the different requirements of the program, so it does vary just slightly on some items, but basically the same. With our home funding, 25% match is required, and the subrecipients are required to provide this match. It's a non-federal match for the amount that they are allocated.
Councilman Richens.
Just to be clear, HOME does not fund new construction, right?
Yes, it does.
It does fund new construction?
Yes.
So I saw acquisition, rehab, resale, and new construction for home. Now, can you blend home funds the same way as you do CDBG? What are the restrictions?
Yes,
mixed-use project.
Home can also be mixed source and funding, absolutely.
So is there a potential that you could have a single project that had market rate in it, CDBG funds, and home funds?
I believe so.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So each subrecipient provides their 25% match. Also, we were required to have Community Housing Development Organizations, CHOTOs. We have to have a set-aside of that each year, 15%. However, that is in the aggregate. So when we start with 2009, because that's when we separated from the consortium, we just have to make sure we always, in the ongoing years, have 15% that has been allocated to CHOTOs. And you'll see their recent funding levels of the home funds. Some of the things that we did last year were accessible rental units, permanent supportive housing, acquisition, rehab, resale, tenant-based rental assistance. And we're now to our timeline for this coming year. And as stated previously, we're here to seek further direction, if any, beyond what the strategic initiatives have already outlined.
Just a quick question. I was scanning through the strategic initiatives. Under slum and blight, I'm trying to see how what area that we fund, as I understand, our entire code enforcement staff, with the exception of one, through CDBG. I don't know if that's inaccurate as of today, but I'd hate to see that lost. That's a great program. I don't know how it fits in, and I was going to try and scan through this a little closer, but so if we can make sure that emphasis is there and not lost, we're already behind the, you know, the ball
on
that one.
It absolutely falls under community engagement of your council initiative. Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's great government talk, isn't it? Community engagement.
Never thought that's the code enforcement.
Cut your weeds. We're engaging.
It's our talk. It's our initiative.
Right. With that, that's the end of our presentation. If you have any other questions and stuff.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I thought it was very good materials that we got and good presentation. I really do appreciate moving this forward. In years past, it tends to get lost in a big jumble of information. And I think you've done a really excellent job working with the applicants for the various grants. I also particularly appreciate the expanded emphasis that we've had in the economic development as a tool to use CDBG funds for. I think it's we have so few tools available in under state law for the job recruitment retention issues. I think that I'm glad it's here, it's identified. I think it could be very helpful for us to continue to use it for the downtown area, the Fiesta area, the other areas where we can work to secure jobs, and I hope we'll continue to have it as a priority. Thank you.
Mayor, can I go up, Council Kevin? One of the things, it may not be this year, but one of the things we were going to start looking at, kind of going to the future of the council, things as would be important is really kind of maybe also looking at programs on the CDBG eligible area, specifically downtown where light rail, during the construction of light rail, during Absolutely. That transition, and coming start now to talk about thinking about programs and opportunities that we can help support the businesses during those times of the construction activity.
Yeah, that's a great idea because that's going to sneak up on us fast.
Yeah.
I know Metro's already been talking about with our staff about signage and
right.
directional and scheduling and all sorts of things. We also, sort of unrelated, we also need to, speaking of signage, look at ways we can assist both with directional signs and also with looking at our back store signage program.
We actually have a program we've got some work coming on.
One of the things I'd like to talk about CDBG is that it's a gem of a program. I can tell you, I was back at U.S. Conference of Mayors, and we had he was number two or three person, an undersecretary or assistant secretary, I can't remember what they call him. He was pretty high up, from HUD, in there giving a presentation to the mayor's leadership program, and he made a comment that almost caused a riot in the thing. This gentleman was an analyst. He was a university professor that was there, and his job at HUD was to basically analyze the programs. And he made a comment that, I've looked at CDBG, and I'm not so sure that I'm ambivalent toward its effect. Oh, my goodness, the mayor's, this poor guy, lucky he got out alive. And then the reason being is that this is probably the best example of how effective our dollars coming back from Washington can be. It's not filtered through some federal agency that sucks all sorts of stuff. Yeah, there are guidelines, but these are direct monies that go directly into the community, and you get direct benefit from it. I think we've brought up some good examples of CDBG funds that have immediate impact, and they're not filtered through the state so that they're lost in some bureaucracy. And the guidelines and the priorities that we have mean that these funds go to nuts and bolts type of programs. And just so you know, the U.S. Conference of Mayors was one of the, along with the League of Cities, those two basically created CDBG many years ago. And we're trying to protect these in Washington because, the federal and the state governments just don't get how important and how effective these funds are. These are our monies coming back. And most of them are at our discretion to use them where we feel as a community they're needed the most, and they do have real impact. And the great thing is we can apply relatively small amounts of money and to a very specific hot spot and get immediate results. So I appreciate this program, and we'll do the very best we can to make sure that these funds get to where they really make a difference. And just so there's a lot of people from around the country, a lot of leaders and municipal leaders, cities and towns, that are fighting, not only to keep these, but to maybe redefine and expand this to where we get money to the cities, where we can do the most good. This is where the action is. So, Councilmember Summers.
Just my opinion. So take that as it might, because it has, you have to get full council direction. Two issues I'd like us to consider as we move through. The first one is, it seems that each year we express concern over how many of these dollars are used by the city to fund city positions that really ought to be funded by the general fund, most of those being neighborhood code enforcement. But there are some others, I'm sure. I think we need to take a careful look at that as we move into our next year's budget and also look at the allocations. We really need to wean ourselves off of these federal dollars for some of those positions. The other thing is, as we go through, we talked a lot about here today. I've heard a lot of discussion about housing and how housing will work. I would like to see us really try to focus as much of our CDBG dollars on job creation. This community, all communities, but this community really needs to focus on high-value jobs and employment for folks, and try to focus our home efforts. I'm not saying we skip the home efforts and community efforts to rehabilitate, but we have home investment funds. You have, $1.5 million here. And then we're going to be looking here in just a few moments on application for the next phase of the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. And we were awarded, $9.6 million? So there's a lot of money going into housing. So I think we need to focus more on the jobs for CDBG. Thanks, Mayor.
Okay. Thank you. You going to stay in the same seat, or are you going to just shift over?
I'm going to stay right here.
Okay. So the next item is to hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, also known as the NSP. I guess you can't say NSP program. That's sort of redundant, isn't it?
Good morning again. And just kind of want to do a little brief of where we're at today as far as the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. When we first started this program almost 2 years ago, to be quite honest with you, we were kind of scared, just because we really didn't know. We had never done anything like this before, and especially once we kind of hit the road with the program, we knew the area that we wanted to work. We knew the type of housing we wanted to do. We wanted the goals that we needed to establish, but when we started going out there and trying to purchase these homes, we kind of hit a dead wall there, because we were having to compete with the investors and so forth. So it was hard right at the very beginning. But I got to admit that staff here, especially Ray Timish here, who's with me, was very tenacious in that, and we stuck to our guns with our goals, and we went forward and really made something of the program, and really put the dollars to good use in the 85204 area. And we had a great partnership with Housing Our Communities during this. They provided great services for us as we went through, and became a great partner also in this process. So with that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and let Ray go through the where we're at today with the program.
Okay, the major purpose of the program was to acquire and rehabilitate foreclosed and abandoned properties in the areas that were hardest hit. Council identified, or staff identified, with council's approval, the zip code of 85204, so that's where we focused our efforts in it. The homes that we purchase and rehab, we resell. This helps reduce the blight, also raises neighborhood standards in the area, and we utilize green technology to make the homes more affordable and sustainable for the homeowners. The activities for this program to benefit the low and moderate income families. Also, one of the things we did incorporate into the rehab process was the actual use of residential fire sprinkler systems into the homes.
Okay, Ray, hold on just a second, because you kind of blowing by a very important point, for council and for the community to understand, is when we went in and purchased homes, first of all, talk about a little bit of your philosophy of the types of homes you identified for purchase. What were you looking for?
We're looking mainly for the homes that were older, and I went after the homes that needed the work. That was the main thing. If you look at the homes that are, there's a lot of homes in foreclosure. They're in good shape. You can walk into them. They're almost pristine. To purchase that type of home, to me, was a waste, because that home will get purchased by somebody, and by purchasing that home, or purchasing the homes that need the work, those are the homes that people were walking away from. Those are the people, the homes that investors weren't even looking at because of the amount of money and effort that had to go into those homes.
And then, thank you. And then talk a little bit about your philosophy as far as the types of, we weren't kind of looking at this as a typical kind of remodeling approach. Again, going back to philosophy, we wanted to create an impact in the neighborhood by identifying homes throughout the neighborhood to maybe set a new standard, raise the standard of development. So talk a little bit about what you looked at as far as the actual improvements you put into the home. And you talked about sprinklers. What are the things that you really, that you look at that may have been different than maybe if we were not necessarily looking at this for the long-term sustainability of the project?
One of the things I focused on were the block homes. Block homes being the most durable homes out there. A lot of the older homes, you look at those homes and they're very sound foundations. The block's very sound. There's no cracks in it. Great workmanship went into those homes, and I hate to just buy it, tear it down, and rebuild something new. There's a lot to salvage there. Plus, it keeps the aesthetic look in that neighborhood. It's one of the things that SHPO wanted us to focus on, and that being the State Historic Preservation Office. They wanted us to keep that look of the neighborhood, the old homes that were built in that time frame. Also, we looked at homes that had illegal additions. That was very common in almost every house that we purchased. They either closed in a carport or they closed in a back patio. The construction that was done was, let's just say, it wasn't code worthy or professional. You know, it lacked professional workmanship. So we try to open those things back up, turn them back into carports. That's what SHPO wanted us to see. The patio enclosures, things like that, they want to see a patio back there again. So we did those types of things. Also, they wanted to take the AC units off the roof, because originally when the houses were first built, they didn't have AC units on the roof. So we agreed to do that, put in split systems. By doing the split system, we were also able to put a higher efficiency unit in it, 16 SEER. Can't do that with a 13 SEER rooftop unit, or 13 SEER system. You can't get a 16 SEER rooftop unit unless you go to a commercial type unit. It's much more expensive. So we were able to do that. We're also putting new roofs on all the houses. One of the things we want to do is try to eliminate problems that a homeowner might encounter two or three years down the road. We don't want them to have those problems two or three years down the road. We want them to be able to survive for the first 5-10 years.
And I also follow what Chris said. I appreciate the fact that, you know, we're not building these homes to flip. And I've had people in the private sector who have talked to me, and they said, gee, you guys are doing more work than we do. And I said, yeah, and that's by design. Neighborhood stabilization to me is not just buying a house and getting someone to live in, like you said, Ray. There's a lot of houses out there. There's a lot of people doing that. We purposefully and by design, and I'm glad we did it, went beyond what someone else would do, because we're trying not only to stabilize a neighborhood, we're trying to lift it up. And the fact of the matter is that if we take some of these homes and we just put a new paint job and new carpet in, that's not going to lift the neighborhood up. It might keep it from going further down, but it's not going to lift it up. And I, being in the business long enough and doing a lot of building down in some pretty rough areas and going in and putting some new stuff in, and I made a good living doing that. But I also found that one of the great byproducts of that was that it was amazing how when we came in the middle and did an infill right in the middle of a pretty rough area, it was amazing how all of a sudden the whole area cleaned up. Because when you had this major investment in the smack dab in the middle of an area where people weren't picking up the trash, they weren't taking care of the houses, all of a sudden the sense of pride kicked in. All of a sudden others came in and invested. And the entire neighborhood was lifted. And so everybody won. And I appreciate the fact that the approach you've taken is to go beyond the minimum and to really create these anchor properties and these example properties that can help, you know, literally, you know, spread an influence and have a ripple effect. And I think that'll happen. We've seen it already happening in some of the areas where adjoining property owners have all of a sudden found it necessary to clean up their property, to upgrade their property, to maybe come in when they weren't planning on, they could get away without that new coat of paint. Now they don't feel they can, and that's good. And I think that's the kind of ripple effect that doesn't show up in your statistics. But as a matter of fact, you can look at your statistics the wrong way and say, why did you spend that extra money to put that ground-mounted unit in when you could have kept it on the roof? And I appreciate the fact that you thought of doing something that could have a longer-lasting impact and a more positive impact on the community. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
And we're seeing just exactly that. We're seeing the neighbors around painting their houses, they're landscaping their front yards.
Yeah.
It's you can go down several of the streets that we've done rehab in. One of them, I believe, is on 7th Avenue, around the 1,000 block or 1,000 block area of 7th Avenue. Since we've done work there, it's just kind of compounded around.
It is contagious, and that's great.
This is like a bunch of HGTV.
And we want to make these homes proud for the people that buy them. And that's the other thing is you do a lot of these, you put that extra amount of money into them. When they purchase them, they're proud of their home, and they want to try to hang on to it, and they do everything they can to do so. We were awarded $9.6 million. The next slide basically gives you a graph of how that was broken up. We did have a readjust a little bit on the demolition. It was hard to identify properties that really needed to be demoed. So originally we had allocated, I believe, $1 million or $1.8 million, and then we changed that to $1 million, and then we took that and changed it down to $140,000. That was for one particular house, is on 2nd Avenue, that was a fire-damaged property, which we basically demoed and reconstructed. She has now moved in there and happy about it too, very happy about it. So we took that money from demo and we moved it up into home ownership. That's where we focused it at. Of the total award here, committed funds, when I say committed, that means we have obligated 100% of our funds. And committed here means obligated. We have all that obligated, but we have about $1,700,000, and probably that's less than that since I created this slide. It's probably about $1.5 million now that we have not spent. What we have spent is probably close to $8.2 million. We've purchased 23 properties, and by the City of Mesa, Housing Our Communities has purchased 14 of those properties. We're up to 37 properties total. Actually closing on another one here this week. Actually, we closed on it yesterday, excuse me. So we're up to 38 properties. We've rehabilitated 23 of those. 11 of them are currently under rehab. And we have three that also that are, actually we're probably down to two now that are pending rehab. Average cost associated with that acquisition of a house was $71,000. Average cost of rehabilitation was about $77,000, and our average sales price is about $113,000 for each home.
Councilman Richards,
do you have a slide that says how many you've sold?
Yes, we do. It's further on down.
Okay, great.
And we've sold 9 actually, and we're closing on one today, so that's 10. So, of the nonprofit housing, we purchased 10 properties, total of 33 units. These are 2 and 3 bedroom units. 5 of the properties, 13 units total, have been rehabilitated and transferred over to nonprofits. 6 of those went to the Mark Center. 7 went to Save the Family. Mark Center will probably receive the remaining amount of those properties. Save the Family has chose that they've taken enough and they're comfortable with what they have at the moment. The acquisition for each one of these is about $24,000 per unit. And the rehabilitation cost is about $50,000 per unit. Under the demolition and reconstruction, we have completed the reconstruction of one of the homes, and like I said, we have she has moved into that home and is very happy with it. We also purchased another property. It was in foreclosure. It is actually a fire damaged property. The owner demoed it all the way down to the slab. It went into foreclosure, so we actually purchased the property, had the remaining slab removed, and we turned the property over to Habitat for Humanity. They're going to start construction of a gold LEED certified house on that property, I believe, the first of next year. This is a map of the properties that we have acquired, and the stars indicate those that we have sold. We have larger maps here if you want to pass those around. But it kind of tells you the concentration that we try to do the purchasing of. The area I really focused on, and with help of Housing in Our Communities, we try to purchase within Main Street to roughly 10th Avenue and from Mesa Drive over to Gilbert. That's the area that needed the most work out of probably all the other neighborhoods in the area. Next slide shows some of the properties that we have acquired, the before and after photos. This one was located on 7th Drive. Again, you had an illegal carport enclosure. There's a number of other items. The back patio in the back was about to fall down. It was added on and added on and added on, and terrible construction. Another property on 7th Avenue that we had purchased and rehabilitated. Again, this one had an illegal carport enclosure, also an illegal patio enclosure in the back. This particular property was on Hobson. That one didn't have a lot of illegal additions or enclosures to it, but it needed an awful lot of work to it. This one here is on Jarvis. This is one of HOC houses that they had purchased. Very fine property. This is probably one of the best. Here's where a contractor went the extra mile in this program. And if you look at what he did, if you go into it, he put upgraded cabinets in it. He put polished brushed nickel, or the brushed nickel light fixtures and doorknobs and handles. And he just went the extra mile on this one. And he pretty much does that on all his properties. This is some of the nonprofit housing that we did. Is on Udall. As you can see in on top picture, they had a patio cover that they put over, and they actually had enclosed these at one time, and then took them out, I guess, written up by code compliance. Also on the back of it, they did a huge addition that they built almost right up to the back property line, which I believe code compliance wrote them up, and they had to remove it as well. So we basically took it back down to the original condition. We got rid of the patio covers on the side that were almost like 2 and 3 feet from the property line. Originally setbacks were on this property were 10 feet on each side. So one of the things we try to do is get most of the properties in compliance, not only with building codes, but with zoning codes as well. And NSP3 has been announced, and we have been awarded $4 million. We are still pending the guidelines on how we can use those funds and what activities they will be for. Initial thoughts are the activities will be the same. And with NSP currently now, under NSP1, we want to continue with our program income. The acquisition and rehabilitation of our single-family homes. To date, we have brought in a program income of about $1 million, and that's with the sale of 9 properties, actually 10 now. So.
But Ray, I think we talked about yesterday on the $4 million award. Until we get the specifics from HUD, what we'll do is, Council, we haven't really received the specific guidelines and direction. As soon as we get that, we'd come back to Council and then talk about the strategy. Do we want to continue with the same guidelines in the 85204,
Or, you know, we have now we have a new we have some program income now that we can continue to reinvest in other properties. Would council be interested in expanding or looking at maybe other areas to invest in? But that's a discussion we can have, you know, once we get the kind of final notification on guidelines. But I just kind of want to plant that, you know, thought about thinking about where we go from here.
It's also going to depend on what HUD tells us or where HUD tells us we can spend that money, because we do. I'm sure they're going to target the hardest hit areas again, and we have to look at those census tracts and see where those hardest hit areas are.
Councilman Richens.
It'll be interesting to see what their new guidelines look at. One of the biggest problems that I'm seeing emerge now, and I need to publicly praise the great job that you guys have done. I was probably maybe even a little overly critical of the process and the project and how it all worked, and I owe you a big pat on the back for the great job and the efficient job, and I think the economical job that you've done. And so I just wanted to say that publicly first. The other is the big emerging issue I'm seeing, particularly in some areas, and we might be able to leverage economic development with some of this, but there are some areas that have rundown fourplexes that are owned or in foreclosure with out-of-state owners, and this is, I think, the biggest emerging problem that we have. I would love to see us consider acquiring and demolishing them and just land banking the land for a while, because I know land banking has been part of the component of NSP. So I'm just wondering if we shouldn't have that as part of the discussion about completely removing them from the market, because I have very little confidence that a lot of those fourplex properties can be rehabilitated and maintained in the private sector. It's just there's too much competition with the well-managed large apartment complexes. And so that's something that, particularly around
if they are, it's by the typical slumlord.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And we're starting to address some of those issues with the slumlord ordinance and the different things.
But taking it out of the slumlord inventory,
particularly a targeted area tying with economic development. And the specific area I'm referring to is the Banner Corporate Center, where we have the two major owned apartment complexes across the street that have been acquired and rehabilitated that look pretty decent for 40-year-old apartment complexes. They're totally remarketing them to employees of that. Now, on the other side, the south side, you have fourplex properties that are, some are okay, but you have the Mark Center there that very strategically has rehabilitated a lot of that block. Their facility is amazing. It's beautiful what they've done. Banner's done an amazing job on that. So can we reward those good corporate players that have reinvested in our community with trying to remove some of the slum and blight around where they are? And in full disclosure, that's my neighborhood. I live right around the corner from there, too, so I get to see it every day. So that's just something that I wanted to throw out removing them from the inventory instead of rehabilitating them. And
right. And, Ray, can I just ask, NSP, is that an eligible CDBG?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, I know we talked about it before, and it was before, and we had decided at that time to concentrate on other areas, and I think we've seen how effective that can be. But I think it's a good thing to consider.
We have purchased a couple of those properties over in that area. We turned them over to the Mark Center just because of the close proximity of them. It's perfect for them. Actually they want to get more in that area.
And if they have a specific use for it,
that could work. To where
there's a
they
huge
have
apartment complex right behind those fourplexes now that is in foreclosure.
Yeah, I think one of our challenges is, once again, there's a lot of money in the market, and there's some good people who are out there buying and making properties look nicer. But the truth of the matter is that, and I said this over at the Mark Center, is the market is not our friend in some of these areas, because all we do is go from dilapidated property to a slumlord who does virtually nothing to upgrade the property, and therefore it compounds the problem. And that's going to offset any of the gains that we've made, either through corporate big-time investment or even private investment. So if we can sometimes stopping the downward spiral, it can be more effective than even going and building something nice, especially with fourplexes. Councilman Cavanaugh, then Councilmember Summers.
Thank you. I want to compliment you on the job that you've done. I've seen a lot of great work by city staff throughout the years on a whole variety of issues, and I think this is really one of the most outstanding efforts I've seen dealing with, in a very short time, with a very complex rules and guidelines. I think you've pulled together and done just a remarkable job that has had an amazing and positive impact on the community, and I can't say enough good about, Ray, what you and your whole staff have done on this. It's truly been outstanding, and I do look forward to the future discussion. Your success has been so good, I get a lot of phone calls and contacts from people outside the 85204 district saying, you know, we need help like that too. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to expand the boundaries of the work that we do. I know that makes it harder, but I have every confidence that you can overcome that challenge. I also agree with Councilmember Richin's concerns about fourplexes. I was one of the original incorporators of the West Mesa Community Development Corporation, and one of the key early findings we had was the problems created by fourplexes in West Mesa in terms of calls for service, in terms of their negative impact on the community. And I think that he has an excellent suggestion to particularly around the Banner Mesa area, which is really, that's a key job center for the community, and I hope we can look at that too. Thank you.
Councilmember Summers.
I'm not going to compliment you. I think your ego will just get too big at this point, so I'm going to pass that portion up. No, I'm just teasing with you. I'm intrigued by the council member's idea of purchasing some of these properties and land banking some of this. I would say that we want to make sure, and I'm sure that you would agree, we're going to want to scrape these to the ground so that they're not sitting there forever. The last thing we need is to purchase them, just board them up, mm-hmm. and then you have problems with squatters, and then they play with sparklers, and then you get fires in the buildings, and then they sit there as burned structures.
Don't we call that practice in the fire department?
Okay. Never mind. I'm just going to get myself in trouble at this point. So we'll want to scrape them. For that matter, we own one, Chris, on the north side of university. That
no, I, if you know, if council is interested, I mean, that would be an option. We could utilize funding for the Escobedo properties. I mean, we've talked about it. It's always been our idea is to, in order to establish an opportunity for economic development or reuse, it would be to, we've always talked about demolishing them, but we just didn't decide where to prioritize which funding source. But it's, I think it's an option, correct?
The only thing is it's not foreclosed property.
Well, as long as we can identify it as eliminating blight in the neighborhood. If you have a fourplex that is not considered blight, it's kind of hard to purchase it and demolish it.
Well, if it's not blight, we wouldn't want to demolish it.
And yeah, exactly.
I think what we're saying is those egregious examples
if you buy a foreclosed property, you could look at probably demolishing it and probably land banking it in that situation. Trying to acquire these from the investors out there, it'd be difficult until they go into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And then you're I like that idea, but it's a long, long process.
Well, we understand it's more difficult.
If you could get all of them all in one block.
See, this is the backside of all those compliments. The problem when you do such a good job is we like you to take on even more challenging things.
Okay.
So that's why I didn't compliment
you. You did such a good job.
It's a good niche for us to fill, though, that the private sector shies away from the hard, long slog projects because carrying costs are too high.
They're in it to make money.
Yeah. So and that's great. I want investors to come and make money in Mesa. That's a good thing. But I think it's a really good niche for us to get into those properties that are really challenging. A good example is that there was the burned out house that you guys did. I've heard from two or three different people that have said what a difference that's made in their neighborhood. And they described to me how difficult it was for that lady to be able to redevelop and live in that house again. Mm-hmm. And because we were able to do that, that's the kind of thing that the private sector just doesn't fill that niche.
Yeah.
But we were able to, and it was probably an appropriate role for us to fill.
Yeah, if I could have found more properties that way, I would have.
I know it's tough, but realistically, these are not, you know, sitting out there a dime a dozen. They're pretty easy to see. You can drive down the street and just look at a property and it just screams, tear me down, please.
Yeah.
And we can go to streets where we know those exist. And the good thing is that with the rental market the way it is, decent properties have lowered their rent enough that people who otherwise would only be able to stay in these really bad properties have been able to move out, which has put financial pressure on the slumlords, which is a great thing. You know, we like good developers to make good money, and I agree with Dave. I hope that good developers make good profit because they'll continue to invest in our community. You know, bad developers, I want them to fall flat on their face. I want them to get out of our community because they leave a lasting legacy that we pay for decades. And if we can identify those ones that just scream out, and that there aren't that many, but there's enough that we don't have to do it for everyone. What we've found out and with your success in 85204 is if we get some targeted ones, it does have that ripple effect. So, you know, I know that it's more difficult, it's tougher, and we're not, I don't think we're saying that that would be the entire program. It's just maybe something to look at, okay. And we know you're up to the challenge. We just know you're that good.
Oh, God.
Dave?
He actually very subtly mentioned a big apartment complex that's in foreclosure down in that area.
Yeah.
And that is a big one that has been filled with calls for service over the years. And I think it straddles two sides of a street, if that's right.
And I'm not sure if it straddles two
one
sides.
One side or the other? That's
It's the orange one that you
the
can't.
The gray with the orange, yeah.
Yeah, you
well,
can't.
That's on both sides of 9th Street,
is it?
Actually. Yeah, there's. But, I mean, that would be a great candidate for a scrape and just plant grass, which is marvelous.
It's unfortunate about these fourplexes, and a lot of that has to do with the first developer that came in there. That was all one development. But, you know, without being able to control how properties are sold, and because they just drew a property line down, it went down to the county recorder's office, sold it off.
Yep.
And that's a problem. You know, if you had one developer there, you wouldn't have all those little fourplexes all divided up. You wouldn't have the situation that you're having now.
Well, the problem is...
I mean, it might be one foreclosure.
Yeah, but the problem is they built them cheaply, too. I mean, they put T111 siding on, which, you know, has a lifespan of maybe 10 years in this heat. And then, you know...
Well, these are all block. These are all block. These fourplexes are, yeah.
They're still...
They're very solid, too. Very solid.
Yeah, they're block, they'll last. But I think what we're talking about as far as Dave's program are the type that are just really bad. So, okay.
Anything Alrighty. Else? Thank you.
No, I'm looking forward to when we get the actual... Ray wants to end this before we start giving him more stuff. Let me out of here. I'll stop at the compliments and go on. No, but... you know, you deserve the kudos, and we're anxious to see if we get this next round because, like I said, I will just also focus on one other thing, is that a lot of mayors had huge problems with this program. And one of the things they were complaining, what brought this also came up in the session with the HUD assistant secretary. He didn't have a very fun time when he was with the mayors. Was the NSP program, and I will tell you that there's a lot of cities who have struggled with this program. They've really struggled with how to implement it. They don't know what to do with the inventory once they get it, and you could just tell from the in many cases horror stories. And I think the reason being is that their staff was not creative, their staff did not extend themselves and did not reach out. And I could just exactly tell what the problem was in their city that we didn't have in our city. And I think it was a good thing that when we first came here, and I know those weren't fun council meetings we had where we challenged you, and Dave was really kind of himself to say he was the most, I don't know how he described himself, but I'm glad your microphone was off. But no, we put a challenge to you. And as we look back, you more than met the challenge. And I'm glad we went through that because I can tell you that our experience has been much different than many cities around the country who are really struggling. And I know that even here in this valley, when we look at the successes we've had with when we celebrated the completion of the last units over there a couple, 3 weeks ago, and one of our sister cities was basically celebrating their first unit yes. that they were doing. You know, I applaud your willingness to really... go beyond what the basics were. And I think that's where people got in problem. Those cities that had problems stuck with basics and the staff did not extend themselves. They didn't go out to the banks. They didn't work with the nonprofits like we have. They didn't get good contractors and good partners in, which you don't have to do, but we chose to do. And that's what I will commend you for, because I think our experience was much more positive and much more beneficial than many other cities that that were there. And so I felt sort of good, because when they asked me, I said, you know what? We've had mostly good experiences. It wasn't easy, but you know, I can say it's been good. We've avoided many of the pitfalls that these other cities have. And boy, there were some horror stories. So thank you very much for not only avoiding those, but for giving us a good story. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda.
Move to approve.
We have a motion to approve the minutes of various boards and committees. I have a second from Councilmember Fenter. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Here are reports on meetings and conferences attended. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Actually, before Ray leaves, I'd like to give one more compliment. Last night I attended the graduation ceremony for the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. And this is Ray staff and Donna Hunter and everybody who works with that program has done an amazing job. This is a program that is governed by HUD, and families who participate in this get receive subsidized housing and case management services with the goal of moving them off of public assistance and into the workforce, and they can earn escrow funds as their earned income goes up, and many of the families use these monies for home ownership. And Mesa has had, they have 5 years to complete the program, but Mesa has had an outstanding program with more than 103 families graduating from that program. And it's been transformative in people's lives, and Ray and his staff have just done an excellent job. The regional director from HUD was at the event last night and, again, was very complimentary of the cities that have participated in it. The alliance last night was Tempe, Chandler, Scottsdale, and Mesa. So I wanted to thank Ray for that. The other meeting I wanted to comment on was Tuesday night. In the midst of all the storms, I spent about 2.5 hours in my district along Peralta Avenue, and that's the area where the SRP power lines along the canal snapped and landed on many homes. And we activated our emergency operations center. The fire command center was there, and I want to compliment fire and police staff on just the excellent work they did. We had no lives lost, no injuries, really. This is a very serious situation because these are giant power poles and lines that landed on homes, and they were live, and they were live for actually, unfortunately, many hours.
Until 8:30, yeah.
Yeah, and so more than 100 people were evacuated, and it was a great use of our connectors who came to help identify who were in the homes, get them out, get them to safety. St. Tim's stepped up and opened up as a shelter for the residents, and I think it was a great example of how our public safety professionals and volunteers came together with the community to save lives, to try to limit property damage, and I want to applaud all who participated in that. Thank you.
And to continue on, I know the next day Neighborhood Services was very busy and helped coordinating pickup of downed trees and, you know, branches and stuff like that, and I know they were hopping down there to get some stuff done, so thank you. Anything else? Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just remind Council, we have another study session Thursday, October 14th. And then on Saturday, October 16th, we have the Rockin' on Ray Road, which will be from 8 to 10 a.m. It's the opening of Ray Road and Hawes Road. So a lot of activities will be out there. Bounce houses, balloons, animals will be I think it's a 5K run out there also. We really do appreciate the many sponsors who have helped out. And just recently today, I was notified the City of Gilbert will also be participating in sponsorship for that event and see the benefit that will help their community also. So we appreciate them helping out. Mayor and Council, also last time we were here, we announced the Household Hazardous Waste event that was last Saturday. Just a report on that we collected the third highest amount of hazardous waste ever. 9,406 gallons of household hazardous waste was collected during that event, and we had 1,133 vehicles go through that event last Saturday. So still a very popular event, and that was preceded in the previous week
weekend by our appliance recycling event, which had 376 vehicles go through that, which filled 4.5 of the big trucks full of appliances. So continue to be a great program. And then real quickly, I'd like to have Jesse. We announced this, I think, this week or last week, but I think most councils had a chance to see this. But one more time, we just want to introduce our new website.
Yes.
And the new look we'll have for that. So, Jesse, if you could kind of run through it for us.
Thanks, Chris. Mayor, Council, thank you for giving me some time this morning to briefly go over it. We actually went live at exactly 6:20 a.m. this morning. And our wonderful staff in IT is actually down there handling any issues that might come up. But just briefly, here's our new homepage. A lot of the things haven't actually changed. A lot of our content is in the same place. A little bit of a rename, but mostly what we're looking at is more vibrancy for our community. We're a vibrant community, and I think our website now reflects that a little bit better than it has in the past. City services, things to do, business. We have moving images at the top that can change on a daily basis. Actually thinking about also changing things as the seasons come through, possibly even the color of the website. We have advertising on the homepage for upcoming events and special things going on, along with the news. And lots of links to important information on the right-hand side. Also departments, divisions, weather, most requested pages that we find from our usage each month. So again, as you'll find, it's the same great content, a little bit better design, same information that's on the old homepage, but just moved over to a design that was a little bit more open.
Are you on the, actual site or the test site right there?
I'm on the actual site. And then if you are testing, one of the big new things that we have that's sort of old for the private sector but new for the public sector is that we have a mobile site. So if you go and check it out on your smartphones or your BlackBerry today, you will be redirected to the mobile site with very basic information, news, city phone numbers, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you, Jesse.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Pretty exciting. Okay. We have the next item is a pre-scheduled public opinion appearance, Mr. Brad Stratton. Mr. Stratton would like to speak regarding the police towing service contract. And Mr. Stratton, if you want to just have a seat there, either one.
Okay.
And you've got 3 minutes, and good luck.
Mr. Mayor, council members, my name is Brad Stratton, and I am a consultant for Thompson Diversified. I hold a notice from the City of Mesa Department dated September 23rd, which states the following. The City Council will be asked to reconsider the police towing services award. The letter continues stating that the Council may decide to rebid the contract. Let me begin by thanking the Purchasing Department for acknowledging that the award was wrong and should be reconsidered. I appreciate the accountability this action displays. Everyone makes mistakes, and it takes courage to stand up and admit responsibility for one as large as this. In that spirit, let's face some additional hard truths. The evaluation committee was wrong when they ignored the RFP and changed the proportional nature of the scoring formula to the benefit of all city towing. Mr. Quedens was wrong when he told the council on live TV that this scoring problem had never come up before because no one had bid $0 before. Our company bid zero for this contract in this city under this formula 5 years ago, and won. When Councilwoman Higgins asked Mr. Credence directly if the original RFP formula could be restored by simply scoring the zero bid at 1 cent, Mr. Credence was again wrong too on live TV, deceiving her into it, believing it could not. When Mayor Smith stated that the numerator doesn't matter as long as the scoring is relative and asked Mr. Credence if the scoring performed by the city was relative, it was wrong for Mr. Credence to answer, yes, it is. It absolutely is not. It was wrong for Mr. Brady to tell the council on live TV that awarding all 80 pricing points to Thompson Diversified would not earn them an award. The statement is only true if you insist on using the illegal scoring chart Mesa developed, which awards all city points they never earned. The purchasing department was wrong when they rejected my protest to the benefit of all city towing. City manager's office was wrong when they rejected my appeal to the benefit of all city towing. And whoever is advising the council that choosing to undertake a completely unfair, biased, and prejudiced rebid is more likely to get my lawsuit dropped than augmented is also seriously misguided. Mesa employees at every pay grade have not missed a single opportunity to ignore the rules in the RFP to the benefit of all city towing and the detriment of Thompson Diversified. After 3 months of Mesa government telling us they had done nothing wrong, we received this memo stating the City Council will be asked to reconsider the police towing service award. I cannot fathom how one can say the city was wrong without also saying that Thompson was right. Fortunately, the City Council still stands as a bright hope that there exists a level of Mesa government who is not committed to breaking the rules set forth in the RFP to ensure all city success. It is within the Council's power to correct this problem rather than becoming a contributor to it. The Council can take offense at these mistakes rather than taking ownership of them. Don't be hypnotized by the complexities of the issue. It's actually simple. First, acknowledge that the original bid process was fair. Everyone read the RFP, everyone knew the rules, and every bid was sealed in private. There was nothing wrong with the bids. Ignoring the RFP during evaluation is what led to the unjust award. Second, admit there is no way in the world to conduct a fair rebid. The city has published our original prices to all of our competitors. Holding a rebid doesn't say we want to make sure this is fair. Holding a rebid says, hey, Auto City, here's the price you have to bid to steal it away from Thompson. Again. If the council agrees the original bid process was fair and a rebid never will be, there are several simple avenues to resolution within the council's power. Reconsider Thompson's protest and award them a contract on its excellent merits. Rescore the original prices using the proportional scoring guaranteed by the RFP and award to Thompson based on their score. Or use the latitude granted to the council by the RFP to ignore purchasing's admittedly flawed scoring and award to Thompson on the truth you've come to understand. I have left 7 copies of this speech here with you. As you enter executive sessions this morning, I urge you to ask why the council can't select one of these 3 solutions. Anyone who tells you that they are impossible is likely one of the people that caused this mess. I humbly beg the council to avail themselves of any of these solutions. Fair is fair, right is right. Math is math. I am not sure if your advisors are criminally negligent or just criminal, but believe me when I say they've been one or the other. The prospect of a rebid is a trial balloon that needs to be popped. It was bad enough having a fair bid process with a bullock's devaluation. Don't make us endure an unfair bidding process with no hope of a just result.
Thank you, Mr. Stratton. Appreciate it. Okay, Ms. Crocker, are there any requests? Other requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
All right, I entertain a motion to enter into executive session.
So moved.
I have a motion from Councilmember Summers, second from Councilmember Kavanaugh. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are now moving into executive session. Thank you.